please the court?
Certainly.
There is one SVP law in Missouri. The law that purports to allow the government to commit Mr. Nelson is the same law that will keep Mr. Nelson and the other 200 plus men who have been committed confined for the rest of their natural lives. This court has routinely said that when looking at a statutory scheme, we must consider all parts of the law together. They cannot be read in isolation. Both this court and the United States Supreme Court have addressed the requirements for a constitutional civil commitment scheme. The first, obviously, is that it must be for a civil purpose, an intent, and have a civil effect. Commitment must be accomplished through the strictest procedures and evidentiary standards. The substantive and procedural safeguards must minimize the risk of an erroneous commitment in an unjust incarceration, and the law must enable correction of an erroneous decision. The Supreme Court has also told us in Hendricks that where a law has a punitive intent or purpose, it has created criminal proceedings for constitutional purposes. And that's the case here. Civil commitment is a significant deprivation of liberty that requires both due process and equal protection. This court has consistently said that civil commitment impinges upon a fundamental liberty and is routinely applied strict scrutiny every time it has examined this law. A week ago, the Eighth Circuit reversed the Carsten opinion, which overruled the Minnesota SVP law. And it said that Carsten applied the wrong standard of proof and scrutiny, and that the case should be decided on a rational basis. The Eighth Circuit and Schaefer in the Eastern District here in Missouri both relied on Jackson versus Indiana to make that conclusion, and both said that the United States Supreme Court has never held that strict scrutiny applies. In Jackson, the Supreme Court said, at the very least, due process requires the nature and duration of commitment bear some reasonable relationship to the purpose for which an individual is committed. But in that case, there was no conceivable basis justifying civil commitment relevant or applicable to Mr. Jackson's commitment. Therefore, the Supreme Court didn't have to decide what standard applied or what scrutiny it would review the law. Of course, there had to be at least a minimum rational basis. But Schaefer found that the law is unconstitutional and that it violates due process, even under the rational basis standard. And it went on to say that Missouri's near-complete failure to protect the men civilly committed is so arbitrary and egregious as to shock the conscience. And that means there is only one unavoidable, unescapable conclusion to be drawn. The Missouri SVP Act is unconstitutional. It violates due process and equal protection. And where the law is punitive and results in those constitutional violations, the proceedings are criminal, and criminal protections must be afforded from the very start. And that includes the initial commitment trial, where the state sought to commit Mr. Nelson indefinitely to the Department of Mental Health. There are several reasons why the law is unconstitutional, the least of which is that there is no unconditional release or discharge. We talked about that quite a bit when I was here in November, and we discussed the SVP law. As we know, the 2006 amendments eliminated discharge. Every time that discharge appeared in the statute, it was replaced with unconditional or conditional release. And it distinguishes now between men who have yet to be conditionally released and men who have been conditionally released. And we have to presume that the legislature intended the removal of discharge to have an effect. Now, Schaefer did read the law to permit modification of the conditions such that the conditions could terminate. But this court cannot read statutory language into the SVP Act that is not there. Discharge is not possible, and the conditions of conditional release can never terminate. Some of them may be modified, but not all of them. And that's because subsection 505 mandates a list of statutory conditions will always apply to any man who has been conditionally released. And arguably, those conditions are worse and are even more burdensome than for a man who is yet to be conditionally released. If Mr. Nelson or anyone else ever obtains a conditional release, it is because they have demonstrated they no longer have a mental abnormality or no longer meet the statutory risk threshold of being more likely than not to commit another predatory act of sexual violence. But as Schaefer showed us, No one has been unconditionally released, and no one has been released to live in a community. And that is unconstitutional. Both O'Connor and Addison from the Supreme Court.
Can you address the argument that it's premature to address that issue here because there's no showing that your client himself is able to get conditional release, qualifies for it, so it doesn't affect him?
Well, it's not a possibility under the law. So the question isn't, does Mr. Nelson qualify for conditional release or discharge at this point in time? The problem is the law is unconstitutional on its face because conditional release isn't possible. But due process requires discharge from confinement.
Why does he have standing to raise that issue? And why wouldn't, if we agreed with you, why wouldn't the answer be to strike the words conditional or anything that doesn't allow total release as opposed to striking the whole law?
Because there is only one act, we have to look at it all together. Mr. Nelson's initial civil commitment can only be constitutional if the resulting confinement under the law is constitutional. This is one statutory scheme.
So you can't ever strike part of a statute? If it's any part of it's unconstitutional, the entire thing has to be stricken. Don't we have a lot of cases severing sections of statutes?
I think we have done that in the past. But the reason why it matters is that we wouldn't send someone to an unconstitutional punishment. For example, we wouldn't try a juvenile for murder and give them the death penalty because we know that's unconstitutional. The punishment itself is. So why then do we commit a man to a program that we know is unconstitutional based upon the plain language of the statute and how we see that statute being applied? The United States Supreme Court has told us in Addington and O'Connor that there is no constitutional basis to confine a man who is not both mentally ill and dangerous. But under the plain reading of the law, that's exactly what the Missouri SVP Act authorizes. Conditional
release. Has there been a finding that he's not dangerous and not mentally ill?
There hasn't been at this point in time, but it wouldn't matter. Because even if found no longer dangerous and or no longer mentally ill, he can't be discharged from confinement under the plain language of the Act.
And so what's the remedy you're asking us for if we agreed with you?
To declare the law unconstitutional. And it would then be up to the legislature to amend the statutory language to comport with the constitutional requirements that this court and the United States Supreme Court have articulated.
Well, in your analogy, if a minor committed a murder and was found guilty and sentenced to death, we don't find that the minor goes free. We find that the consequences of the finding of guilty may not meet the Constitution. So why would we find that the entire act and commitment is defective?
Well, one of the reasons that this court has declared the law was civil was because there was discharge from confinement. And we have to look at all of the provisions together. So when this court examined the law in Norton, in Kaufman, in Van Orden, there were three primary things that this court relied upon. One was an assumption that there would never be a punitive intent or effect of the law. Another was the assumption that someone committed to the Department of Mental Health would and could be discharged. The burden of proof was beyond a reasonable doubt. And there were mandated periodic reviews for anyone who had been committed. But the effect of the 2006 amendments were to eliminate all of those procedural safeguards. So the problem is that there's just one unconstitutional part of this law. When we look at it as the whole, all of the components of this program and everything that happens when someone is committed is unconstitutional. One of the other reasons why it isn't constitutional is because there's no least restrictive treatment environment. This court did say in Norton that where the appellant challenged the trial court's failure to consider a least restrictive treatment environment, that there wasn't a due process or an equal protection issue. But the claim that Mr. Nelson is making is different. Mr. Nelson has challenged the SVP Act and not the action of the trial court. And he's arguing that the act is unconstitutional precisely because there is no least restrictive environment, which indicates a punitive purpose. And he has a due process and equal protection right to avoid undue confinement, both in the duration of confinement and the nature of confinement. Karsten found that failure to have a least restrictive environment in Minnesota failed strict scrutiny. And Schaefer found that the failure to reintegrate anyone into the community by having a least restrictive environment violated the Constitution both under rational basis and the shocks to the conscience test.
But here Mr. Nelson had a long history of sexually assaulting the guards and some of the workers at the prison. Why would somebody with that kind of history be entitled to a least restrictive environment?
Well, anyone who is committed to the Department of Mental Health has the right to the least restrictive treatment environment that's compatible with their safety and the safety of others. What a least restrictive environment looks like for one person may not be the same as what it looks like for the other. But the problem is the Act doesn't have a least restrictive environment for anyone at all. The state's brief suggests that Mr. Nelson isn't entitled today to a least restrictive environment because of his behavior. And that's just another example of the government using this as a punitive measure to punish him. He's entitled to a least restrictive environment if today he conforms his behavior such that he would qualify for a reduction in custody. But there isn't one that he could even go to. But this court has said where civil commitment accomplishes a constitutional purpose, those who are committed are required to be held in the least restrictive environment compatible with this safety. And the terms of the SVP Act are at odds with itself. In subsection 501, the legislature has clearly stated that the primary purpose of a conditional release is for someone to be living in the community. It's for outpatient treatment and rehabilitation, and the goal is that they don't return to a secure facility. That means there necessarily must be something less than a secure facility for someone. But the plain language of the Act precludes a least restrictive environment. So the statute is interfering with treatment. In Schaefer, every expert who testified agreed that treatment requires community placement, but that there is no community placement. So where someone can never be discharged from confinement, and will always be held in the most restrictive environment that's possible, we have to question, is this punitive or not? And the answer is clear, it is.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I want to begin with the statement that Mr. Nelson's counsel just made, that holding him in swords is punishment. That's not the case. Holding him in swords because, in the context of the least restrictive environment, is protecting the staff members.
Has the legislature in their 2006 amendments eliminated characteristics of the Act that were relied upon by the court to find it civil in nature rather than punitive?
No, would be the short answer to that question, Your Honor. The longer answer to that question is a debate or a question about what does conditional release mean. Section 505 of the Sexually Violent Predator Act does not require that a court must always impose conditions. In fact, the first sentence of that section reads that the court shall review the plan and determine the conditions that meaning the court, deems necessary to meet the person's need for treatment and supervision and to protect the safety of the public.
Well, so, opposing counsel said there are some conditions the statute requires always be in place. Is that correct?
That's what opposing counsel just said. That's a reference to Section 505. The second sentence in Section 505 then goes on to say that at the beginning of a conditional release, here are the provisions the court shall order. But the first sentence says the court shall review and the court shall impose the conditions that it deems necessary. So if an individual who has been released to the community becomes sufficiently safe, all the court could do or would need to do is impose a condition that an individual not commit another sexually violent offense. That sort of supervision is so de minimis that it's not a restriction at all on liberty.
So you're suggesting that there's more than one way to read the statute and then it can be read in a constitutional manner or a manner that's consistent with the prior cases saying what you need to have to be a civil statute?
Exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly right.
And that's what Schaefer found on that issue.
The Schaefer decision, yes, that portion of the Schaefer division, decision. That's obviously a long decision. But there, relying on this court's precedent, the Schaefer court said that this court interprets the law in a constitutional manner.
The opposing counsel says that would be reading something out of the law that legislatures put in.
Not so, Your Honor, because the first sentence empowers the court, in fact, gives the court a duty to impose the conditions that the court believes are necessary. The second sentence and then the associated subsections of Section 505 are the conditions that should be imposed when an individual leaves the facility to go to a conditional release, sort of a starter set of conditions.
What do you rely on for your statement that de minimis conditions can really be ignored, you're really not conditional? I mean, the prior cases did note that discharge was possible, and if just total discharge is no longer possible, why doesn't that change the analysis?
Because a condition that is so de minimis as to not commit a future sexually violent offense doesn't sufficiently.
But you're under the jurisdiction of the court then still, and you haven't been released, so you're still only on conditional release.
Correct. But in that situation, there's no reporting requirement.
Are there any cases that address that issue, either way?
No one has ever reached that level of safety, Your Honor.
I know not in Missouri, but I mean around the country. Has any court addressed the issue of whether that is sufficient to still fall in the civil side?
As far as I know, that's a question of first impression.
Okay.
But there are cases that talk about, in the habeas context, a de minimis injury. For instance, somebody who had been discharged from federal habeas or discharged from state confinement in a federal habeas case tried to get habeas relief, arguing that their injury was to their reputation.
Right.
And in that case, a reputational injury is so de minimis that it didn't justify habeas. I think that kind of rationale applies in this case as well. That a de minimis condition like do not commit a future sexually violent offense doesn't transform the statute into a punitive purpose. But I want to return just briefly to protecting staff members at the Department of Correction. Mr. Nelson's own expert agreed on cross-examination that Mr. Nelson touched or grabbed a guard so forcefully that she had to lock herself in a prison chapel to escape. That's on page 474 to 475 of the transcript. That's in addition to Mr. Nelson's history of violently threatening guards while masturbating. And that ties into his diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder.
Is opposing counsel correct that there's only one level of confinement? So even if someone didn't display this kind of behavior, or at some point the treatment, which I'm sure you're giving, becomes effective and he no longer displays that behavior, is there an alternative, less restrictive environment in which he can be kept?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor, and there's a twofold response. The first response is that before we reach that level of analysis, we need to ask if Mr. Nelson has standing, which, of course, he doesn't.
I'm just asking a question about the facts.
Yeah. Right, but then that leads me to the second point. Mm-hmm. There are no facts in the record about what treatment is like at SORTS. Mr. Nelson provided.
So we don't know if there's more than one, if there is a less restrictive environment available?
There's no facts in the record for this court to have. Nothing that went through the Missouri State Court process to reach this appellate court. There has certainly been testimony in the federal case, but of course, the state has the ability to file an interlocutory appeal. That trial court's fact findings have not been affirmed. And so, really, there's only speculation left. I can tell you that there is an effort made to move men to a different facility, and then an effort to move them into the community. Some men have been moved to the community. But of course, that's happened after the Schaefer decision. So even in that non-final, non-binding opinion, it doesn't reflect all the facts that exist today, which goes back to what makes it so difficult for this court, as an appellate court, to review that question, because there are simply no facts in the record for this court to make its decision.
Thank you.
So I want to turn to this question about whether the use of the term sexually violent predator in the jury instructions and during voir dire and by the court violated Mr. Nelson's rights. The only standard of review on that type of claim that I could find was Darden versus Wainwright, which talks about when some sort of alleged prejudicial statement is so inflammatory that it affects the entire trial with error sufficient to deny due process. That's certainly not what happened in this case. Mr. Nelson's primary authority appears to be State versus Perry, a 2010 decision of this court. But Perry doesn't provide Mr. Nelson with any support for his position because, of course, in Perry, the individual was not on trial, a civil commitment trial. He was on trial for one act against one child in a criminal context. But even in that case, where the prosecutor referred to the individual as a sexually violent predator in closing argument, this court found that there was no due process violation. So even at its most extreme, Perry does not support Mr. Nelson's case. And perhaps the most important distinction between Perry's language about how that's an inflammatory or prejudicial word is context. In this case, as the court's pointed out, the jury heard details about his long history of offending while in the Department of Corrections, and the court has heard details, or I'm sorry, the jury heard details about the fact that Mr. Nelson broke in to a woman's house through a window and violently raped her on the broken glass. So the idea that in that context the term sexually violent predator would be prejudicial, I think, ignores the issues in the case and the facts in the case. The term sexually violent predator is just that. It's a term. It's a term for an individual who has committed a sexually violent offense in the past, who has a mental abnormality, and has a certain level of risk. Those are the three issues in the case. That's what the evidence was about. And so I don't think that it was error. And under the law that I've been able to find, it was not error for the jury instructions and for the court to use that term. Does the court have other questions about other points?
I want to revisit the issue as to if, in fact, the legislature's modifications change the nature of the proceeding so that it no longer has the circumstances or the characteristics that were relied on by the court to find it a civil proceeding. How does that not create standing as opposed to that he's at a point of being conditionally released?
That's a great question, Your Honor. He would not have standing for an as-applied challenge, but this is a discussion about a facial challenge is what you're asking
right.
about. So in a facial challenge, the court will look at the entire act. So this is a situation to determine the way the act is written is a sort of a totality of the circumstances. So simply changing one piece of the statute is not necessarily enough to transform an act from punitive to civil. The court looks at all of the elements of the Sexually Violent Predator Act. And again, I would return to the fact that conditional release can be so limited. The conditions can be so limited. No reporting requirement. No requirement to check in with a parole officer. No requirement to report to the court. The only requirement, literally the only requirement, being that you not commit a future sexually violent offense. And under a facial challenge, the court looks for any way in which the statute can be upheld.
Is that the only key change?
That's the key change that Mr. Nelson is focusing on in this case.
And
another change, there are other changes. So, for instance, the change from beyond a reasonable doubt to clear and convincing evidence. But the United States Supreme Court in Addington explained that due process talks about the burden of proof in the context of distributing the risk among the parties as weighed against the potential harms. Mm-hmm. Our legislature and the United States Supreme Court said that's a question the legislature can answer. Our legislature in 2006 looked at the risk to the community, to the individuals, and they decided that the proper way to allocate that risk between the parties at trial was clear and convincing evidence. Mental health cases are different than a lot of other cases, just due to the very nature of the fact that mental health cases involve what is happening inside of someone else's mind. It sort of goes back to the law school, criminal law classes about whether someone had knowledge or purpose or criminal negligence. Those are difficult questions to answer. And so the legislature has determined that in this context, the appropriate distribution for the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. That appropriately protects the community, and it appropriately protected individuals like Mr. Nelson. The state still held to a relatively high burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he meets the statutory criteria. That's enough to protect his due process rights. Certainly on its own, but even in, if the court wants to consider, like I said, the totality of the circumstances. So an unconditional release being changed to a conditional release with one option in conjunction with a burden of proof that distributes the risk by saying clear and convincing evidence, that's still not a punitive law.
And are there cases that have addressed a similar change in the discharge law, so conditional release being the only option? Are there cases around the country that have addressed this situation and its effect on whether it's civil or criminal?
As far as I know, this is an issue of first impression. I have not found other states where their statute was either started with unconditional release and then eliminated it. I've not found a state that has that.
Or are there other states that have only conditional release? Do we know?
I think that there are other states that have that, but of course they couldn't raise a claim that, modifying it to unconditional.
But they could raise a claim as to whether only conditional release is sufficient. Are there those cases?
I have not found any of those. But I won't represent that they don't exist, just that I have not seen them. But again, it's a totality of the circumstances. So, or not a totality of the circumstances, a totality of the Act's provisions. And here, when you look at all the provisions, all the procedural protections that individuals like Mr. Nelson receive, it's clear that the Act certainly survives strict scrutiny, but even more certainly survives a rational basis. I know I only have a few seconds left. I submitted a letter brief to the court to inform them about the Eighth Circuit opinion. I just want to make clear that the district court in Minnesota found that the elimination of the least restrictive environment violated due process. But the Eighth Circuit, in fact, expressly reversed on that particular issue. I think that's on page 16 or 17 of the slip opinion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The state is quite frankly wrong in how it is choosing to read the provisions of the statute relating to conditional release and the terms and conditions there, and has taken a position today in front of this court different than any I have heard when I have petitioned for conditional relief on behalf of any of my clients. The statute is clear. There are mandatory conditions which must apply. The court has discretion to order any other conditions it thinks should also be applicable. But it does not have discretion to ignore what the legislature has said are mandatory conditions. And that's been the argument I've heard whenever I've petitioned for conditional release on behalf of any of my clients. But we also know that where a law is punitive, it must be construed strictly against the state. And that must be the case here. I also want to encourage the court not to conflate Mr. Nelson's conduct with the plain language of the Act. Mr. Nelson's behavior may be such that today he is not eligible for a least restrictive environment, but that does not make the plain language of the SVP Act constitutional, where it precludes such a treatment environment. Schaefer did address what type of facilities are available for men who have been committed, and there are two. There's one in Fulton, there's one in Farmington, and they are behind razor prison wire, patrolled by armed guards, and they are both considered maximum security facilities. Schaefer told us there are no community-based options or any least restrictive environments.
Now, do we have anything in the record here? Opposing counsel says that some things have changed in response to the district court decision in Schaefer. Has there any record on that?
Not any record in this case because the government was successful in arguing Mr. Nelson couldn't present any evidence of treatment, what it would look like if he went to DMH or if he wasn't committed. But this court can look to Schaefer. It can look to the findings that were there, where the court said there was overwhelming evidence at trial that the law was unconstitutional and violated due process.
What authority would we have to look at a federal trial court record and presume any facts?
Well, we don't even have to look at the record. We can just look at the opinion and what Schaefer found and told us there. But we can focus on the facts of this instant case and any similar case necessary for the development of a constitutional rule and to address the legal issue with data relevant and adequate to make an informed decision. And that comes from Ferber and Jeffrey, which were cases that Mr. Goodwin had cited in Mr. Kirk's case, but is dropped from his respondent's brief in this case. We can look to Schaefer, and Schaefer is persuasive authority, if not binding on this court. There is a huge conflict of law at this point. The federal court has declared this law is unconstitutional, and that means Mr. Nelson has a claim in federal court. If this court were to find something contrary or less than what Schaefer found, what will happen is the court system will be inundated with habeas petitions so that we can exhaust our remedies in state court and get in federal court to raise the exact same claims. This law is unconstitutional, and the time has come that we have to act. Every time this court has had an opportunity to look at the law, we've looked at it piecemeal. We've looked at one part just for today, whatever this one issue is. We have to look at the entire act, just like the state said.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.